Good afternoon. Thank you, Lincoln, for the kind introduction, and I also want to take the opportunity to thank the organizers for organizing this fantastic workshop. It has been really inspiring the last couple of days, and hopefully will be also this afternoon. And I'm very happy that I have the chance to talk about our research efforts towards chemically stable ground state molecules of sodium potassium. My name is Sebastian Will. I'm a postdoc in Martin Sweerlein's group. That is also where this research happens at MIT and within the Center for Ultra-Cold Atoms of Harvard and MIT. So, well, we have heard during that conference about many ways of how you can reach very cold temperatures with molecules, from stark deceleration to buffer gas cooling, even using a centrifuge. So we are going on our quest towards very cold molecules by doing first what we are pretty good at so far, which is cooling down atoms to very cold temperatures. And once we have created a very cold atomic sample, we have this wonderful tool which is called Feshbach resonance that allows us to create very weakly bound molecules, which are essentially atoms on a stick very far away from each other at a fairly low temperature of a few hundred nanokelvin, and which corresponds to like 10 kilohertz or so. And then we face the sort of bizarre situation that this is a vibrationally very highly excited state. And if you compare the energy to the ground state, we see a gap here of like 150 terahertz, which corresponds to 7,000 Kelvin. And well, that is more than the temperature on the surface of the sun. So kind of the Feshbach state is a very, very far away from home if you compare it to the ground state. But still, it's worthwhile to take on this challenge to get to the ground state here. And well, this is just comparing to other energy scales in the system. So the temperature is always much lower than the vibration energy scale, rotation, or hyperfine energy scale in our system. So it's worthwhile to take on the challenge to go to ground state molecules, because this is a way, if you pick heteronuclear atoms for the molecule, this is a way to create dipolar interactions, which are long range, expressed by this 1 over 3 cubed expression here in this term. And it's anisotropic, so it depends, the strength depends on how the dipoles are oriented with respect to each other. And in particular, it can be attractive or repulsive depending on which of the two terms here dominate. And if you consider many body systems, this interaction term creates always interesting Hamiltonians with interesting properties and interesting phases in 1D, in 2D, in 3D. I also write here zero. Consider like dipoles trapped in a very deep optical lattice on the sides of a very deep optical lattice. There's like many predictions on what to expect, and we use like these here. And fermionic molecules made out of two alkali atoms in the raw vibrational ground state are a very nice system to realize such dipolar gases. It's a clean implementation in the sense that you don't have direct contact interactions in the system. The direction and the strength of the interactions is tunable with the external electric field, AC or DC electric field. And depending on which molecule you choose, the dipolar interactions can be the dominating energy scale of the many-body system. And well, then the prospect is to create really intriguing phases such as exotic superfluids, P-wave superfluids, or fermions, non-trivial ordering from like classical crystal to a supersolid, and you see the competition between superfluid and crystallization. You can think of schemes to realize quantum magnetisms in optical lattices. Quantum information is a big point here as well, because there's a prospect of creating topologically stable, protected phases. And also quantum chemistry can be a fantastic field of study. So luckily, we already have learned from pioneering work in Gila and at Innsbruck how we can create from Feshbach molecules or from cold atomic samples ground state molecules. The way to do it is first create a degenerate sample of atoms, then use the Feshbach resonance to generate Feshbach molecules, and then do a stirrup transfer, a two-photon process, to actually get tightly bound molecules. And it's interesting, again, to compare the scales that are involved here. The binding energy for the Feshbach molecule is like on the order of 100 kilohertz, let's say, and the binding energy of the ground state is more than 100 terahertz. The internuclear distance shrinks by a factor of 30 or 40. So from atoms on a stick, we get to a new sort of particle, which is very tightly bound. And the dipole moment changes from essentially nothing to, in the case of rubidium potassium 2.560 by. However, in the case of rubidium potassium, we have discussed also this week, there is the thing that you have chemical reactions in two-body collisions, and therefore one might think of different alkali combinations. And our pick is sodium potassium out of the reason that we are hoping for chemical, or that we know that it's chemically stable for two-body collisions. So this is a list of all fermionic bialkyon molecules, and here we see that actually only two combinations, sodium potassium and potassium cesium, are chemically stable against two-body collisions, and also stable against trimer formation, which has been shown in this paper by Jeremy Hudson. So sodium potassium seems to be a good choice to go for. And actually, when we started our work, we were very surprised because sodium potassium has a long history. It has the first paper where this molecule has been studied. It dates back from 1924. And there's a whole bunch of papers, and many more than the one shown here, over the last 90 decades or so. So actually, in this paper from 1934, they analyzed the molecular spectra, and already, I think, in this paper, they got the structure, like the quantum numbers of the spectra, right, which is amazing, just a few years after the development of quantum mechanics. This is just sort of for showing what they did back in the 1924. They recorded some absorption spectra of this molecule. So it has been served as a sort of textbook molecule for actually. And as I said, it's chemically stable against this two-body collision, as one can calculate quite quickly if one knows the numbers on the back of an envelope. And the other really good thing is that it has a huge dipole moment of 2.7 dBi, which if one puts in some numbers, it can lead to dipolar interaction energies in many body systems of like 30% of the Fermi energy. And these nice properties have also been recognized by others, of course. There are, one does not exaggerate if one says like there's the worldwide efforts to pursue sodium potassium molecules. There is a experiment in Hanover by Silke Ospikaus, who's here, I think, and in Munich by Christoph Gulli, who was here until yesterday. In Trento, they are pursuing this. The Chinese Academy of Science is setting up a new experiment. There's a new experimental setup that is pursuing sodium potassium, and in Hong Kong as well. So it's a growing interest in this system, I think. And well, the properties seem obviously quite good, but actually the true story is we got into this business much more evolutionary. We just had the possibility in our setup to study sodium and potassium, and we, you know, went on with our studies and more realized that this is a really experimentally a really nice system to work with. And actually, we just grew like a year ago. We didn't know that we want to do ground state molecules in the setup, but we grew into this topic because we realized there's no way out. It's just a very nice system. So I will actually tell you that story of our research during the last year, which included making a quantum degenerate Bose-Fermi mixture of sodium and potassium and finding the Feshbach resonance. We really had to start from scratch. There was no theory, no experiment on Feshbach resonances in that mixture. And then we created Feshbach molecules of sodium potassium, and then we pursued further, did further studies towards the ground state molecules of this combination. Let's start with the first point, and I want to introduce you to our experimental setup. This is actually a sort of massive apparatus, big vacuum chamber with two Zeeman slowers. This slower is able to cool down sodium and lithium, and this slower is able to cool down a potassium atom, so it could perform laser cooling on potassium atoms. And we are focusing here on potassium 40, and we heard in Florian Schreck's talk actually already that the natural abundance is very low of potassium 40, 0.01%. But we are actually using the Zeeman slower for enrichment. We do not have an enriched source here, but we enrich our sample, so to speak, spectroscopically. We use laser cooling to sort out the potassium 40 isotope, and it works reasonably well. We trap in a in a simple quadrupole trap, which is plugged with a blue detuned laser beam in the center, and do evaporative cooling there until like up and down to like a microkelvin or so. And well, this machine is super versatile. It can cool many different isotopes, so one can in principle study Bose systems, Fermi systems, Bose-Bose mixtures, Bose-Fermi mixtures, and Fermi-Fermi mixtures. Of course, one cannot do everything, so we focus on NAK so far. And this is how it's, so it's a little bit more messy. It's more than a year old now, and now it looks even messier or even more packed. But in any case, we can collect in a MOT, we can collect a billion sodium atoms, and we collect like 10 to the 7 potassium atoms. But the good thing is, that is a nice story. We don't throw away many of them during evaporation due to like Fourtrier's properties of the trapping potentials. Here you see different magneto-optical traps and degenerate clouds. In this case, potassium-41, potassium-40, lithium-6. So this has been done in the past. But now we focus on sodium-potassium, and we can very efficiently, sympathetically cool potassium together with sodium. Sodium, we have a huge, so to speak, refrigerator for potassium, because we have a huge sodium atom number in the system. And the cooling works very efficiently. We can get down to like in this data, 0.6 T over TF. We can actually, by now, we are quite a bit better, I think. But in this publication, we had like 200,000 atoms each at 0.6 T over TF. And we can also actually imbalance the numbers a little bit more and get a situation where we have a huge Bose-Einstein condensate of sodium and just potassium atoms, which is an interesting system to study impurity physics. In any case, however, we see in this set of pictures, we see that the potassium cloud actually develops a bimodal structure, which was for us the first hint that we have a very strong attractive background scattering length between potassium and sodium. Later, it turns out it's about minus 700 A0. And also a nice feature from the experimental point of view is that we can do very fast evaporation in our plug trap and dipole trap within like in total like 8 seconds or so. It's quite fast. Okay, here again, a plot of the phase space density as a function of atom number during our cooling sequence. And I do not want to go into much details here, but the red points are the increase of phase space density in potassium when they are sympathetically cooled with sodium. And we see here essentially a straight line going straight up, which means we increase phase space density without losing atoms. This is because in the dipole trap that we are using, it's just, it has a trap depth for potassium, which is higher than for sodium, and sodium actually leaves the trap first and just cools potassium. It's very nice. So we set out with this cold sample to find Feshbach resonances, and as nothing was known, it was just a shot in the blue, actually. And here you see for one spin channel, scanning from fields from 0 to 200 Gauss, what's happening when one looks at the loss of potassium and sodium as a function of magnetic field. And you see like a whole bunch of Feshbach resonances. It's incredible, just in one spin channel. And actually, you see a very broad Feshbach resonance here, which will be important later. And we also observed P-wave Feshbach resonance, actually multiplets, not doublets, as is usual, because we are at very low. Here is a chart of all the Feshbach resonances that we found just in 4 MF channels of potassium combined with sodium in the 1-1 state. It's like 30 resonances here, very broad S-wave resonances. This one is the broad one that I showed you before. It's around 30 Gauss wide, below 200 Gauss. So for an experiment, and down there we have some P-wave resonances. Okay, let's go on. We want to learn more about these Feshbach resonances. Loss spectroscopy is not a very precise tool in the sense that it doesn't tell us so much about the character of Feshbach molecules and of background scattering lengths, for example. So we set out to do radio frequency spectroscopy on close to one to this broad Feshbach resonance that I showed you before. So why do we do radio frequency spectroscopy to create molecules and to study the system? It yields a lot of information about the system compared to Feshbach ramp across the Feshbach resonance from above. We actually learn something about the binding energies of the molecule. And for a wide Feshbach resonance, we can expect that this works very well because the molecular wave function can have a large extent and a good overlap with two unbound atoms. So we are shining in a radio frequency photon close to a transition of potassium and create by these two atoms on a stick, essentially. We are, the conditions under which we are doing this is like 150,000 atoms each. And the temperature is actually fairly high. We are using sodium close to the condensation temperature, which corresponds to potassium at T over TF of 0.4. The reason is that this gives the best conversion efficiency of molecules. And for the spectroscopy, for the experts, we are using a Blackman pulse. So we first see if you're driving this transition between the MF states -3/2 and -5/2. We first see atomic transition. If you go a little bit further down, further up with the frequency, we actually also see a second peak pop up, which is the molecular transition. One interesting feature on the atomic peak is. We see actually a long tail, which is due to mean field interactions between sodium and potassium. Again, a signature of very strong scattering length here. And the conversion efficiency that we observe for the molecule is about 15%. It's very similar to what people have seen with rubidium potassium. We focus a little bit more on this molecular peak. So in order to extract the binding energy very accurately, one needs to know, so the binding energy the binding energy is like basically the distance between the atomic transition and the molecular transition. But the question is which point should I actually take in these peaks? And so we looked a little bit more closely at the molecular peak and tried to fit the structure. So we developed like a little theory which includes the Frank-Condon overlap of atoms and towards Feshbach molecules and of the probability to find the matching momentum pairs. And if we do this, actually, we can fit this molecular peak very nicely. And we see that the true binding energy is actually neither the peak nor like the onset of the peak. It's like somewhere in the middle and allows us to extract the binding energy quite nicely. We can also dissociate the molecules. It's yet another smoking gun for that we have created Feshbach molecules. Just by dissociating with another RF pulse, the molecule into the -7/2 MF state of potassium. And we can fit this nicely. We extract like a compatible binding energy with the RF association. It's very nice. We can do this for several magnetic fields, which means we can plot the binding energy of the Feshbach molecule as a function of the magnetic field. And we see a very nice smooth curve here, which allows us then to extract the properties of the Feshbach resonance. So this Feshbach resonance has the background scattering length is about -700 A0. The width is like almost 30 Gauss, and the center of the Feshbach resonance is 140 Gauss roughly. And the molecules are open channel dominated over a very large field range. This is like having two atoms on a stick. It has a significant singlet admixture, which we thought is a good thing because we want to go to the singlet ground state, and that might help us actually to do two photon transfer. I think there's data in Silke Ospelkau's group where this is apparently not a big help to do the two photon process. But anyways, we are very hopeful that we are getting there. Okay, so we looked into some more properties of our Feshbach molecules. One is we image directly the Feshbach molecules and we can extract the number of molecules. So we have 20,000 molecules. We can, from time of flight measurement of the molecules, we can extract the temperature, which is 500 nanokelvin in this case here. And we actually made also a very surprising observation, which is the lifetime of the Feshbach molecules. The longest one that we observed is 140 milliseconds, which is actually very long for Feshbach molecules of this kind. This is very nice properties, nothing that will stop us from going on to do a two-photon process. So the molecules, Feshbach molecules, will not decay during the time of a stirrer pulse, which is only a few hundred microseconds long or so. So looking at the nice properties of the Feshbach molecules again, we sat down and said, okay, this is very nice, what should we do next? And then we were soon very sure that we want to go towards ground state molecules as opposed to, say, studying Bose-Fermi mixtures of sodium and potassium, looking at like some states in optical lattice or so. Okay, so what's next? So the Feshbach molecules essentially live in the highest vibrational level of this triplet, A triplet sigma plus potential. And to get to the ground state, we want to do a two-photon process, a stirrup process, similar to KRB, involving the B singlet pi potential, which is spin which has singlet triplet mixing due to spin orbit coupling, with the C triplet sigma plus potential, and then we need a second photon to go down from there. And the first crucial part to know about is these intermediate states, the vibrational levels of excited molecular potentials. And we need spectroscopic information. The good message is, as I told you already, there is a lot of spectroscopic data on sodium potassium. But of course, due to the low natural abundance of potassium-40, nobody ever could see, in experiments that involve the heat pipe or something like this, it could ever see sodium potassium 40 molecules, but only sodium potassium 39 and potassium 41 are studied. So we have to mass scale to get an idea where would be the vibrational levels and the excited potentials. We mass scale the potentials or the vibrational levels, and to get the vibrational levels for our system. And then, based on this, we do photo association spectroscopy. Actually, for simplicity, we are doing it not on Feshbach molecules, but we are doing it on atomic mixture, and use a very powerful titanium sapphire laser that is on top of this capable of doing like 20 gigahertz scans. So we can get a good impression of what's going on in the excited state potentials. So here you see just an example of the data that we take here. Okay, we scan the laser a little bit, then we see a dip, and then the atom number comes up again. So a signature of a vibrational, excited vibrational level is simultaneous loss of sodium and potassium. And we actually also do a sanity check. We check that there's no loss of potassium without the presence of sodium. So we know we have a simultaneous loss of both species, which must be vibrational. Okay, so I talked to you about the photo association measurement. So this is essentially done. We set up right now the Raman laser systems and are just about to do two photon processes in our system and figure out vibrational levels of the ground state potentials. So this is the two points here. Then next thing, once we find the ground state, we can do stir up. First thing to do is probably a lifetime measurement to figure out if John Bohn is right about the sticking collisions, despite the chemical stability of our sodium potassium molecule. And then we will install electrodes and go on and hope to set out to find interesting phases of this dipolar Fermi gas. And one thing I want to mention also is actually the way the dipole moment actually tunes as a function of electric field in sodium potassium. You can plot this when you know the dipole moment and the rotational constant of the molecule. And we see that we actually can reach like a debye already at 3 kilovolts per centimeter, which is a nice number. It should be not, I mean, we haven't done it yet, but it should be doable, let's say. So that's good. We get at fairly low electric field a strong dipole moment. And actually, there's a factor of 5 between the dipole moment of rubidium potassium and sodium potassium. And this factor of 5 is actually very helpful, I think, because if you look at the dipole lengths, which is the characteristic energy scale of the dipole-dipole interactions, you see that the dipole moment goes in quadratically. So having a factor of 5 here is like an order of magnitude more in the dipole length, which means we can reach like a dipole length of a micron at like 1 debye. And if we go to pretty much the limit, we can hope to get a dipole length of 7 micrometers or so, which is, and this becomes interesting. I mean, it's always interesting. The physics becomes interesting when the dipole length is on the order of the interparticle spacing. So this ratio is what matters here. And for sodium potassium at realistic densities, we have the realistic chance to get to ratios here on the order of one or much higher. And then if you look into phase diagrams that are predicted, we can hope to see really the competition between superfluidity and crystallization, which is plotted here as a function of this parameter RD, where we really get the interesting regime when we are like, you know, on the order of 15, 20, whatever. So it's a really good factor of five that we have here in the dipole moment, I think. So let me conclude here. I showed you that we found a lot of Feshbach resonances in the sodium-potassium mixture. It's a wonderful mixture from the experimental point of view. The Feshbach molecules live very long, open channel dominate over a wide field range. The sodium-potassium ground state molecules will be chemically stable. The dipole moment will be large, and we hope to realize strongly dipolar Fermi gases. I want to thank the team. Jibu Peter Park is a fantastic force in the lab. It's a lot of fun to work with him. We are making great progress over the last months. Cheng Chun Wu just graduated a few weeks ago. He was spearheading the Feshbach molecule effort. Jenny Schloss is a first-year grad student, and that all happens in the group of Martin Zwierlein, who is a fantastic support, and is really really great to work with. It's fantastic. And of course, I also thank all the funding agencies and you for the attention. Thank you.
Questions? Since you're working with these higher spin channels of the potassium, do you see any evidence of or measure any of the spin relaxation rates in this system, or is they too small to measure?
So we haven't really measured it. It doesn't seem to be a terrible problem. Yeah, so we were actually surprised. I mean, usually with rubidium potassium, you work in -9.5 or -7.5 if you're bold. But here, it's fairly stable.
Okay, and just a follow-up question then, you're using one of the higher spin channels with RF driving. Is that the way you're going to think you'll be the preferred way to make the Feshbach molecule,
yeah,
or are you going to prefer to do magneto association?
So magneto association seems like the more straightforward way to do it. We actually would like to do it. You have seen this whole zoo of Feshbach resonances. So the deal is, it's actually quite hard to get above, with a B field above the resonance without crossing tons of other resonances. So for us, it's easier to inch our way through the zoo of Feshbach resonances by actually doing like two or three RF pulses and change the magnetic field in between to get next to our preferred Feshbach resonance. Actually, you know, this is the bad side of having so many broad Feshbach resonances in the system.
That's true. One more follow-up question on that then. Since you have many Feshbach resonances, and therefore presumably from Tiemann, I guess you know the assignments of all these, some of them might have much better Frankonin factors up than others. Mm-hmm. And if so, you examine it, you're going to try to find and optimize the which Feshbach's going to be best.
Yeah, we just stick around now these days still with the broad Feshbach resonance that we have here. So we have actually not thoroughly analyzed the other Feshbach resonances yet. That could totally be. Yeah.
More questions?
Yeah, I was wondering, in your photo-association data, you said that you have indeed seen in the lines the spin orbit coupling between the capital B and small c states, or you know that there is one. I was just wondering if you are indeed able to kind of see it and quantify it, or maybe characterize the lines and to address, to assign to them some kind of, you know, more or less important triplet and singlet character. Can you already see that and interpret that from your experiment? Or?
So what we see is we see deviations from the mass scale prediction, mm-hmm. and of like several gigahertz usually or something like this, which we assign to spin orbit coupling. Okay. We have not done a very thorough analysis of this yet.
Okay.
But for the triplet potential, for sure, we can always find our line within like, you know, few gigahertz or few tens of gigahertz close to the prediction.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we also see like, you know, effects where you have like the triplet line goes up a little bit while the singlet line goes down a little bit. This is like the pushing of the two lines that you would expect.
But to set up your stirrup path, mm-hmm. you will try one or the other to see what works best, or do you have already an idea how to select one of those lines to?
Yeah, our hope is, we mostly looked at the Franconian overlap of different possibilities, and we will just try experimentally, I think, okay. So far. So far it's going well, so we'll okay. See. I don't know.
Thanks.
Yeah. I always have many questions. Anyone else want to?
Yeah, Silke.
Just maybe one comment to Paul's question about the Feshbach molecules. So we actually, in collaboration with Eva Thiemann, and Tom is here, he has a poster, analyzed the wave function, the Feshbach wave function in the vicinity of the resonance that they are using here, and actually calculated all these dipole transition matrix elements, including spin orbit, including triplet singlet mixing, including everything. And I think the dipole moment is 0.05, the transition dipole moment is 0.05 dBi. And using then one state in the electronically excited state, on a thermal beam, we were able to transfer from like the vibration ground state in the singlet potential to specific vibration state in the triplet potential. So I think, probably trying to use different Feshbach resonances, you don't have to do this. This one will just going to work.
You went also via the same excited state potentials, I think, right? The singlet pi and the triplet sigma, right?
Yeah. So you can, there's the poster still up.
Yeah,
we'll
have to look at it. Yeah.
Okay, any evidence of sticky collision? So Francesca presented this very preliminary data. Can you do some similar kinds of measurements? What are your thoughts about verifying or perhaps overturning some of these predictions?
So the thing is, right now we are just at the Feshbach molecule level, right? So we are still a bit away from testing this. So, experimentally, a lifetime measurement to do is not very hard, I guess. Just tear up into the molecular state, wait for a variable time, and then come back. I think that's possible. So you will see what is the lifetime of the molecular sample. And like Francesca showed nicely, that you have this data which is neither like perfectly fitted by a two-body decay or a three-body decay. You can probably extract information from this. Should be possible, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I'll keep asking questions. Okay. So, what about the optical lattices? So, do you have plenty of access to your chamber? Do you plan to make optical lattices? A lot of us have been talking about doing many body physics, and these are very ideal molecules for that.
So in our setup, what is definitely possible without much hassle is doing a 1D lattice, right? So you have 2D systems. That should be no problem. 3D lattice should be possible as well. It's so personally, I have worked during grad school a lot with optical lattice. I would know how to do it. So I think it's doable. 3D lattice is a bit more challenging. It's an engineering task, so to speak. But it's doable. 1D lattice should be quite straightforward.
Okay. More questions? No. Okay, I'll ask a third one. So I'm wondering about the phase space density that you really need to get a dipolar crystal. So yeah. The phase space density to get a dipolar crystal is perhaps 30, something like that. And I'm wondering if you can actually realistically get to that phase space density. Why do you think you can?
So there is one thing. I was mentioning it only in passing. So the problem so far is that the bottleneck for your temperature of the molecules is not the stirrup process. It's actually the initial association of Feshbach molecules. It is just most efficient. It's just most efficient when we're working with samples that are close to condensation temperature of sodium, which then translates into few hundred nanokelvins. The reason is that the phase space overlap for Feshbach molecule association is just becomes lower and lower the colder we get. We can do this at much lower temperature. We mapped it out as a function of temperature. It has been done at GILA also. We observe essentially the same. You get the best conversion efficiency when you are fairly hot. Obviously, if you have the Fermi C and want to combine or to create Feshbach molecules together with the Bose-Einstein condensate of sodium, it's not going to work. So that is the bottleneck, actually, and I think it's the same bottleneck in rubidium potassium. And so we have a little hope that in our system we can squeeze out a little bit more conversion efficiency, actually exactly because of the strong background scattering length, which we see here, this bimodal structure on the Fermi cloud, which kind of sucks in the fermions into the Bose-Einstein condensate. So by exploiting that a little bit more, we have tried too hard. We might squeeze out a few more percent, but it's I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure how well this works in the end. So there are, of course, ideas around of how to use a optical lattice to force fermions and bosons to have good phase space overlap, which means creating a bosonic Mott insulator along with a bent insulator fermions. It's on paper, it's doable. Experimentally, it's a big challenge, I think. But that might be a way to go in the end to ensure that you have huge molecule numbers and a very cold temperature at the same time.
Okay, Kankun has a question.
I guess this question is maybe more for the theorists that come up with the idea of this dipolar crystal. That in that paper, there is like a specific numerical value saying that this phase transition is going to happen at this RD equal to, something there. The question is, how robust is that? Because obviously it's very difficult to achieve that criteria, but like, is that number going to change between 10 to 30, or is that like really good at like 18 or something like that?
I think it's a question to the theorist.
Is Hans Peter here, actually? Yeah. He may not be in the room, but I think he would answer that question easily.
I'm not sure if that's a Monte Carlo calculation. There's another paper with a trapped system. Yeah. That is actually, I think, in a homogeneous system. Is it? Okay. Yeah. I don't know.
Do you want to?
I think this is a Monte Carlo calculation, so that's fairly robust. Mm-hmm. But you also have other phases if you start tilting the thing. So you have these stripe phases, and there are all sorts of other things going on. So you don't just have to look for this thing. Mm-hmm. And also these excited phases.
It's just exemplary. Obviously.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think this is the hardest thing to get, and I think it's very interesting that, it's very courageous to put that down as your goal, but I think there are lots of things on the way.
Sure.
And if you look at some of the work that Benjamin Lev has been talking about, even fairly weak dipoles, you can get quantum liquid crystals, and there are a lot of which there's a sort of super solid discussion going on in the program, and those are all things you would get long before
Absolutely.
You get to this regime, even without a lattice. So I think those are probably more promising.
I'm aware of this, but I just put it in because it features like this ratio of dipole length and interparticle space.
Let me ask you a question that's actually fairly important in this context and other contexts with molecules, and maybe you've thought about it, and that is detecting the molecules that you make. Are you going to use the kind of the standard method, which is to make them back to atoms and image atoms, or have you actually thought at MIT about doing molecule imaging?
Well, I think to start with, we will do it just as it has been proven to work, steer up back and detect atoms. If you want to detect the molecules directly, you're not going to scatter much photons, right? So that's a problem. You have no cycling transition. If you figure out a cycling transition, maybe you can do it.
Okay. Jun Yi did it with the KRB. So
But the signal is very weak compared of atoms. So I think still the working horse is steer-upping back and counting atoms. Yeah, of course, would be very nice. You can think of fancy schemes where detect the interaction of molecules and atoms, and then image the atoms in a spectroscopic way that you only image the atom when there was a molecule on the side or things like that. But those proposals are around, but it's. To begin with, you just want to stick with the molecules. I think you don't want to admix more atoms, which makes the whole thing much more complicated. I don't know. Yeah.
More questions? We have time for one or two more.
Okay, I'll make a comment then. This one micron for the dipole length. If you want to ask about phases that go beyond just nearest neighbor phases, depending on nearest neighbor interactions, that's really very perfect to start. seeing something that's a little bit longer range. So basically, KRB is a nearest neighbor problem from the perspective of the of lattice physics, mm-hmm. but this is beyond that.
This is actually beyond that. Yeah.
And I think that's another strength of your molecule. So I think it's good to mention dipolar crystal, but as far as things that you might do and comparing it to KRB, I think that's a particularly important number, 1 micron.
Yeah.
That gets you a couple of sites out, right?
Exactly. It's like if you think of a lattice, I mean, where the spacing is like whatever, 500 nanometer or something
right.
like this, it's a good number.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's thank our speaker again for a great talk. Okay. Our next speaker is Gerrit Groenboom. Probably horribly mispronounce your name. I apologize. At least I think I can say Gerrit. I can't possibly say the name of your university. Can I say Radboud? the title of his talk is Elastic, Inelastic, and Reactive Collisions Between Open Shell Polar Molecules. I would like you to notice what department he comes from. It does not say physics there. And we very much appreciate you coming and explaining some chemistry to us. Thank you.